Good morning, Joe. Good morning, Vitaly. How are you?
Good morning.
Good morning,
It's
thank you.
Friday.
It's February already. Oh my goodness, where did the time go?
Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, when you're having fun, yes. So welcome to the Cyber Confidential today. I thought we'll discuss get together and discuss the topic of CISOs and startups. And obviously I'm in that world, and I know Joe and Vitaly, you guys work with a lot of startups. And so often founders will come to me and say, "Hey, can you introduce me to so and so?" Sometimes the intro is great. Other times they were like, kind of not in the mood of talking to startups today or this week. And Joe and I spoke a little bit on this topic, sort of casually. And I want to bring this up as a discussion for our episode today. Vitaly and Joe, should CISOs care about startups? Obviously, the answer is depends, but when should you care about startups? What should you care about in terms of how to work with them? And so I'll start with Joe. Since you are, I think you're pretty deep with some of the startups that you're collaborating with, right?
Yeah, that's true. I advise a number of startups in the cybersecurity space. I try not to do too much of that because I spend most of my time doing security consulting projects inside companies, and I don't want to have a conflict in the same way that a security executive inside one organization doesn't want to have a conflict between their, their personal interests and their day job. But yeah, I think this is a really important question. And I've thought about it a lot more since I've been traveling around and spending time with CISOs in different parts of the country and different parts of the world. Like where we live in Silicon Valley, we just think about startups all the time. And so, as a security leader, when I see a problem that I don't have the right solution for, I often think, oh, is there a startup out there that could fix, solve my problem? Because, in the types of environments that Vitaly and I've worked in, we're inside technology companies that are moving quickly, and your infrastructure and your architecture aren't static. And so a lot, and in fact, they've evolved a lot from, the environments that the products that came out 5 and 10 years ago were built to secure. And so we often have more edge situations where we need to fill gaps than if you go look at, a company that is on the East Coast that's been, that still has some mainframes and things like that. And so I have looked to startups, but and sometimes it's worked out great, and sometimes it's worked out terribly. And that's the stuff that I think we should talk about on this call, so that security leaders, when they're thinking about going with the startup, they have all the pros and cons in mind.
Yeah, I would add. So first of all, I think there is a tremendous value of working with the startup community, right? Not only you get to learn kind of new bleeding edge technologies or the ways people might be solving the problem that's different from the way we've thought about solving it, but there's also this impact on the industry, right? We learned a long time ago that we can't just build the walls around ourselves and solve cybersecurity problems, right, just within our own walls. We have to fix it as an industry. And the way that we can help as CISOs, we can actually not only advise, help build products, provide feedback as the industry as a whole. And the only way to do that is continue investing in startups as an industry, right? You can't just have big platform players, Palo Alto, Cisco's of the world, maybe even CrowdStrike's, right? They're not going to be able to solve every single problem we have. There's tremendous amount of startups that actually approach problem space in an interesting way. Some will work out, many might not, right? But our involvement as an industry will be very, very helpful. But there is also dangers there, and we can talk about conflict of interest, right? And a few other things that you need to be very mindful of how you approach this engagement. But I think just in general, there is a tremendous benefit of being engaged with the startups in the world.
Yeah.
I think, sorry, You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's the East Coast CISO, and obviously, you know, in my line of work, I deal with startups all the time. And I told her that, you know, I really enjoy that experience because I learn a lot. Every day I talk to a startup and I learn something. And she started laughing. And I said, why? And she said, I wish I have time to learn. It's just like every day I'm back to back with putting out fires and you know, compliance reports and everything. And she said, none of these is about learning. So, and I think, you know, going back to your point, Joe, that some of the outside of Silicon Valley CISOs, their tasks and their what their normal day looks like is very different.
Yeah. But that's also a challenge, right? Is trying to find time for this is hard. We're all very busy. We're all back to back every single day of the week, right? There is a your day job that you have to do. So when a VC friends come and say, "Oh, you know, we have this very interesting startup. Can you spend a few minutes?" It's challenging, right? So you do have to prioritize and sometimes be picky and choose like who you actually going to invest in and which companies you would like to partner in or VCs, that is a big challenge.
Yeah, I agree. I have really enjoyed, and you know, when I was the CSO at Facebook and Uber and Cloudflare, I did like to talk to startup founders, but I always was like you said, I always had to deal with the never-ending series of them coming at me, and what I would try and do was focus on the areas where I wanted to learn. The good part is that there are a lot of them out there who want to pitch to you. But you know, I remember there was a point in time when I was at Facebook and I was thinking about insider threat and I wanted to learn about that new category, user behavior analytics, back, you know, when that category kind of started taking off. And so we were trying to build something on our own internally. And the question, you know, that I would always have is, does it make sense for me to build this myself? Do I want to invest my engineers in building something that's not a core to our company's mission? Or can I find someone else to build it for me? And so I would want to learn like how are the newest companies in this space thinking about building something? When I was at Facebook, we built OS query on our own. And one of the things I learned about building a piece of highly used open source software is that I could dedicate, you know, six engineers to building it for 6 months, but then they don't roll off. You know, you build a piece of software, you have to maintain it forever. And so a lot of times we think, oh, we can just solve our problem on our own. And I quickly realized, no, I have to maintain that software. And if there's an open source community around it, I have to maintain that community. I have to invest in that community too. And so as a security leader, you really don't want to take your engineers and put them on building things, unless you're committed to putting them on building the things forever.
But you said you made a great point. You said, do I, you know, making the decision, do I want to invest my engineer's time to build something that is not core to my business? But if you're not in the security company, when is security ever core to your business?
It's not. And the reality is when you work in a technology company, the most finite resource you have is engineering bandwidth. And so, do I want to diminish that bandwidth for something that's not core to the company's mission? It better be really important, from a security standpoint.
How do you make that decision? And this is for both of you. And Vitaly, I know you're in the company that's very engineering culture heavy. And you guys have done, you know, interesting security innovations that actually push the boundary of the industry, right? And there are startups coming out of Netflix security teams in the past. And so how do you make that decision, buy versus build? And what kind of criteria at the high level, go into making that decision.
That's a great question. I think it starts with kind of a company culture. You know, Netflix, Meta, Google, you know, Uber, as Joe worked in, they all have this engineering-driven culture. And their first desire is always build, 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 right? And the reason is because usually you're starting something that's very new. There's not a lot of solutions out there. That's problem number one. And problem number two is, how do you solve something at scale? Scale comes into play. A lot of products on the market might not be able to support the scale that many of these companies operate in, right? So historically, you focus on building because it either doesn't exist, or two, there is a scalability and integration problems. Over time, though, market catches up. There are a number of startups, even larger companies starting to invest heavily. So if you are an even technology company and you're thinking to build endpoint solution right now, right? You probably need to think twice, how much are you willing to invest, not just upfront, but as Joe said, maintain something, whether it's open source or closed source, there's a maintenance component involved forever, supposedly, right? Or possibly. So you have to make that part of your calculus. If you buy a third-party package or a tool or a platform, what is the cost associated with purchasing? What's the maintenance cost? And also you have to think about integration costs within your environment, right? All that comes into this kind of a ROI TCO component, right? That helps you make a decision whether it's more advantageous to actually build that internally and allocate resources, or is it easier to buy and integrate, right? At the end of the day, there is a cultural aspect, but also financial aspect that kind of drives the decision. Netflix historically built a lot of tools internally out of necessity, right? We were one of the first cloud native companies out there at large scale. And a lot of tooling didn't exist yet on the market, whether it was in data protection space, cloud security. So out of necessity, the teams had to build really good products. But in some areas, market has caught up and maybe even leapfrogged. And the only way for us to actually find out is to meet with the community, with the industry, those startups, and to learn what they're working on, how they're thinking about solving this problem. And then it's a ROI discussion.
Yeah, I can think of it's in those situations, like an environment like Netflix. When I was at Facebook, startups would come to me and say, "You could have our product for free," because they wanted to be able to say that we were a customer. And I would look at them and I would say, "If you build your product for us, nobody else is going to want it because our environment is so custom, so forward." That it would just wouldn't be like it would be a disfavor to that startup to take them in and then really push them to build what we needed. And so we would often prefer not to go that route with a startup. Like one of the dangers is that I have started working with a startup, and then they signed the US government as a customer, and then all of a sudden they're building for two masters. And what the private sector wants in security and what the government requires for their contracting, I really regretted working with that startup because they started chasing that government contracting and then they're like, "No, we're not going to build any more features for the next 18 months because we have to do all of the government compliance work." And you're just like, so like one red flag for me in working with the startups is I often ask them like, "Okay, who are you building for? And do you anticipate the government as a customer?" And if they say, "We're going to go up big after government," I'm like, "Well, then I'm probably not going to work with you."
Okay, that's good to know. But these days government business become, well, actually these days is a very hard thing today, but about 18, 12 months prior to this, government has become a very good customer for startups. And it's all the defense tech and everything all emerged. And startups do have to look at government contracts as a visible channel of go to market. But Jill, I want to push on this. I know you guys at Uber, you did a lot of work with the Phantom, right? For instance, and that was a success case. And what I heard is that you guys had the need inside. You actually proactively went and worked with the Phantom founding team and gave them use case and everything. Was that true?
So when I was at Facebook, we built our own internal tool on our detection team. We took four or five people from different teams because our detection engineering felt very manual and clunky, and we wanted to take it to the next level. And so we pulled together a team inside of our Facebook security organization that had some awesome, talented people on it. And we, I think Fawr Flynn led it, and Chris McCann was part of it. Like these are people who are significant security executives now, and they built inside our security team a product that we called Blackbird. Today you'd call it a SOAR platform. We didn't. There was no such thing as SOAR back then, but they essentially built a version of a SOAR for us inside Facebook. And then I left Facebook and I went to Uber, and so did Fawr, and so did Chris McCann, and so did about 40 people from my Facebook security team. And we get over to Uber and we're like, we really miss Blackbird. You know, it was really a great tool for detection, but do we want to dedicate the engineering? Like we were dealing with so much security risk and so many things all at once at Uber. We're like, we don't have the bandwidth to build this. And I happened to be at a dinner that was hosted by a venture firm in Palo Alto, and I was seated next to Oliver Friedrich, and I said, you know, we started talking, and Oliver, I said, Oliver, what are you building? And he said, and he described, and I said, you're describing Blackbird. Can I connect you with my team? And then we became the design partner for them, and like we were happy to like tell them what we needed and wanted, and they built it. And so that was a great example of a partnership between a security organization and a startup. Now, so that's when it works the best. What happens that I works the worst is when you do a partnership with a startup and then they get acquired and they stop innovating or something. Like this is way, way long time ago. I was about to sign a contract with NetWitness, and then I started worrying about this 3-year contract, and so I put in an out.
RSA? Was it RSA?
Yes.
Yeah,
So
okay.
I was going to deploy NetWitness before we even, and we signed the contract, and before we even started implementation, it was announced that RSA had acquired NetWitness, and we were so happy that we had gotten an out in the contract, because a year into the relationship, now that they're part of RSA, it felt like nothing was moving. And I'm not saying anything bad about the NetWitness team or anything like that. Obviously, like we liked them and we liked the product at the time, but it didn't continue to evolve. And I could give you, I don't want to name too many companies, but I used to be I used to love working with Carbon Black, and I deployed Capsulate, and you know, Capsulate got acquired by Sophos, and then you know, they tell you, oh, now we want it to be, you can have Capsulate as long as you buy our entire suite of server management tools. And you're like, so like
Yeah.
a big gotcha that I've learned about is that if I'm working with a startup, I want to have in the contract that we have an out if there's an acquisition.
Yeah, I mean that's certainly a very valid concern. I was an investor in Capsulate, and I remember the discussion about them being acquired, and I remember some of the customers had concerns about what happens afterwards. I mean, when you're a startup, you get acquired, the first thing they want you to do is integration. And then you're like, I can work on integration or I can work on new features. So it's and that is one of the concerns of some of the executives, typically outside of Silicon Valley. I mean, even inside, you have that concern is, can I continue to work on them because they are there's a visible risk, right? IBM probably won't get acquired. Well, these days you never know.
Never know.
Never
No.
know.
But this is one of the reasons why you go with a startup, right? Because you can influence a roadmap. They can develop features much faster that address a specific problem, right? Working with the larger companies, the roadmap is very long. You might have to wait a year, 2 years, or longer. So after acquisition, that is one of the bigger concerns. How are they going to get integrated, and are they going to completely change or affect our ability to do it, right? As Joe said, becoming the design partner is beneficial to both parties because you can get to market faster, you're actually addressing specific problem that we might have. When they get acquired or working with larger company, that's always a fear. The opposite of that, though, you have to be careful, right? You have to understand the financials of that startup. You're starting to work with somebody that maybe doesn't have a good cash flow and going to run out of money in 6 months is also problematic because you're going to waste a lot of cycles. So you have to do your due diligence around startup financials and understand what their run rate looks like, right? How much run rate room do they have?
As a CISO, you're going to ask them about their 100%. Financials? Really?
100%, yeah.
You have to. It's I've been in the situation where I was working with a startup and they pivoted. You're like, because they realized that, you know, so like we'd invested a bunch of time as a design partner with this startup that was, it was actually in the physical security space. And, you know, we wanted to be kind of forward leaning in terms of like when an employee comes in, just like it would key on their phone and they could go in and out and you wouldn't have to carry a physical badge. And there was a startup that was doing this really, it had really good technology, but they didn't have enough customers because the physical security world tends to move really slowly. And we had deployed their hardware to one of our offices, and then they pivoted to become an basically like an IDP and move away from hardware. And I had to explain to my CEO why I had spent money on this hardware for a company that doesn't exist.
So. Well, that's tough. Yeah, but that's always a risk, right? They can always pivot.
That's right.
And you can't put in the contract say you cannot pivot.
No, right. But you can look at about source code, right? You can actually put some terms in the contract around escrow and other things, right? But you do need to be mindful because you're investing your own resources, right? And you want to make sure that the company is valuable. Is they going to stay around longer for you to actually get benefit out of that engagement? So depending on the company, you know, whether it's a CISO or vendor management group or purchasing group or legal, whoever, somebody will ask the question, are this company financially liable, right? Viable. And for how long? Because you don't want to actually invest resources into a company that's not going to be around in the next 6 to 12 months. Having said that, though, there are categories where maybe that's okay, right? Yep. The risk of you or the company going under or pivoting might not have a huge financial impact on you, right? So there is a balance there you can choose, but it's still a part of that calculus that you have to figure out.
Yep.
What level of detail do you ask questions? I mean, you certainly don't want them, don't ask about their, you know, give you the detailed financial statement as part of the contracting, do you?
The full cap table, everything? No.
But you have. But you do have in-depth conversations about this. You want to understand. So I don't know if this is really apparent from the outside, but a lot of the best security organizations inside companies have dedicated vendor manager. It's something that I realized pretty early on at Facebook is that I had 20 engineers and they all wanted to sign contracts with third parties and our centralized procurement wasn't sophisticated enough yet. And so I hired, instead of hiring another engineer, I hired a vendor manager. And she came in and she cleaned up all of our relationships with vendors. And so when I went to Uber, one of the first hires I did was to bring a dedicated vendor manager onto my security org. And I did this and I worked, and everywhere I've been, I've worked with the finance team so that we could have at a minimum a shared resource who just understands every single risk and opportunity in every contract that it's a typical security organization is spending a large percentage of its budget on third-party software. And so you need to manage that well, and you need to manage all these risks because it's almost like you're managing a portfolio of third parties that need to be kind of coordinated. And if you're going to mix some startups in there, you're adding in some particular risks.
Do you have a vendor management person, Vitaly? Oh, okay, interesting.
But it depends on the org, right? In some orgs, you have technology spend centralized and you'll have kind of this VMO, vendor management office, that focuses on contract negotiations, renewals, right, etc. You also have the procurement team that's somewhere else under operations outside of technology team that's usually involved. But the larger companies, you will have somebody that's helping in a specific space, like whether it's a security or something else.
Yeah. So pivoting a little bit, the question that one of the discussion points came up earlier about conflict of interest, right? So as security, the industry of security becomes more lucrative, and we see more and more interesting and borderline questionable practices where security leaders join the cap table of security companies, or join the investor list or advisor list of VC firms. And we certainly have seen some press articles about it. Now, I'm a fan of if there's benefits to financial benefits, we should all be part of it at some level. But where do you stop, and where's the ethical boundary that we should all be concerned about? And it's not clear.
I think so. First of all, Joe, I'll jump in. This is nothing new. This has nothing to do with cybersecurity. This has been around in capitalism forever. If you're on the board of director of any company, you have exactly the same opportunity for conflict, right? If you engage with any company at any level, whether it's technology, operations, finance, there's always a possibility of conflict, right? Of interest. So what we rely on is, first of all, the person, right? And ethics. Every company has ethics process where you should disclose any engagement you have, whether it's financially beneficial or not, sometimes, right? With your ethics committee or ethics team. And whether it was at Google or at Netflix right now, we have a good process in place. If you are working with a specific company, whether it's in advisor capacity or investor capacity or board of directors capacity, right? You're going to have to make sure you, first of all, notify your management chain and ethics committee and legal. And secondly, you excuse yourself from any decision-making process when it comes to vendor selection or product selection, right? And make sure there is a trail, other trail, to make sure you can actually show that you were not involved in decision-making. So even if I will introduce somebody, startup that I'm involved with, to my team, I will actually clearly state up front whether there is any relationship with that startup or not, and that I have no say or influence in the decision making there. Now, for at Netflix, it's much easier than maybe some other companies. We have this cultural notion of informed captaincy, where you have ICs making the decision sometimes on which vendor or solution to go with, or manager. And a lot of times I might not be involved in the decision-making process because I trust my teams to make the right call there. But yeah, if there is ever even a remote possibility of a conflict, we just notify the ethics team, we notify legal, my managers, and explain what my involvement with the company is.
Yeah, it's I got a lot of exposure to this early on in my private sector career because when I was at PayPal, I was asked to be the business ethics officer for the company. And what that meant was that I had to be the person who received all of the disclosures about potential conflicts and people wanting to do things. And it was, I mean, this was early days of PayPal. And so everybody wanted people from PayPal to be advisors to them, if you
And
go back.
how early was
So this
would you
was like 2005, six, seven.
Oh, okay.
And so there were a
Early.
lot of really, really cool, smart people at PayPal who were doing a lot of different things, and none of them were the security team. Like, I didn't get any requests from the security team to do conflict things, but it was like the product leaders, the engineering leaders, the sales leaders, the marketing leaders, they were all doing things with startups. And so I got the repetition of having to look at every single one of these and talk about it with the person and really think about our policies in that area. And so when then I moved into, the CSO role at Facebook, and I almost immediately started getting approached and offered all of these opportunities and free trips to this and all that, I automatically put it through that lens. And I even got to the point where I feel like I didn't even want my team to know which companies I was associated with. Like, so for example, when I was at Cloudflare, my team came to me and said, we want to look at email security solutions on top of what we get from Google. And I had a couple of years before that invested in material security when it was just three guys. And so I didn't even want my team to know that I was an investor in material because I was worried that they would just, oh, if Joe cares about that company, we better, so when the team went to me, I said, we have a this, I am invested in a company in this space. In fact, they may be on the list of companies you're looking at. I'm not going to tell you which. And I asked our CIO to step in and oversee the vendor process with them and support them. It turned out great. The team picked a different email security company that we at Cloudflare ended up really enjoying their product. And then we acquired the company. So it was actually a good outcome that I was recused and I didn't, and the team didn't know that I was using material or invested in material.
Even though you didn't tell them, they didn't know. How do you stop the company getting on the phone and say, "Oh, you know, we really enjoy working with you guys because, you know, Joe's an investor in our company. We'd love to deepen the relationship." Right?
Whenever I've done an investment or become an advisor, I've put in language or asked for or communicated very clearly that you won't have me as a customer. When I become an advisor to a startup, I tell them you will never be bought by a company that I work for.
But you actually specifically say we were not, because in this particular case, you said you were relying on your team and the CIO to make a decision. So in this case, it's possible they
Yes.
would buy it, right? So it's.
But I want to lower expectations. Like I actually had an experience when I was at Facebook that I signed with a startup to be an advisor. It was in the identity and access management space, and it was like in the early days of FIDO, and I was really interested in FIDO, and so I wanted to learn everything. And so I asked, so I said I would be an advisor, and I was very clear with them. You will never have Facebook as a customer because I didn't want their salespeople to be bugging me. And within like 3 months of me signing the contract, their CEO reached out to me and was like, hey, can we come and talk to Facebook? And I said, absolutely not. And then he bothered me again a month later. And I said, absolutely not. And then he bothered me again a month later. And I said, I resign as an advisor. I like this is the one third rail for us.
Okay.
I think that actually goes to the core of why, on both sides, why do CISOs want to become advisory, all right, advisors? And then why do companies want CISOs to be an advisor? If the company wants CISOs on their board or an advisory board purely for networking or ability to bring into their company, that's a red flag, right? Networking piece is fine. Introduction piece, we all do that, right? But as Joe said, if somebody is, come and join us on our advisory board, but can you get us into your company? That's immediately a red flag. And there is a too much room, even with the right processes, right? The optics are just not good. Even though nobody's doing anything illegal, optics are bad, right? But if you put those terms up front and say, I'm here for the following reasons, and this is what I'm going to provide value, one of them is not going to be my company. But I'm going to be able to introduce you to the right people that might be able to actually use technology like this. You just need to be very honest up front and watch out for those flags.
But that's an interesting thing because I can tell you most of the time the startups want you to be on their advisory board because your name and second because possibility of a commercial deal,
Yeah,
right?
of course.
And if the second part is not a possibility, meaning that putting you on their advisory board will actively eliminate the possibility of selling into your company, then it's a lot less incentive for them to put you on the advisory board. Now, that may be the right outcome, you know. So I'm just thinking that there's actually a lot of that going on in the industry, right? Being an advisor to the company and later became a customer. So I mean, it seems like you guys have a very strong standards of how that should be done or not done, but it's not practiced everywhere.
No, and that's a key, right? It's not that it's immediate no for every company you work with, right? It's you have to make sure you have the right rules and process in place to avoid even optics of something illegal, right? Or shady being done. So if you're an advisor for a company and you learn that their product actually might be able to solve real problem in your own company, right? There's no problem using the right processes, legal process, right, within your own company to actually introduce them to the team that could solve a big problem. So by itself, it's not a big no, right? But going into it, if that's a insertion, you just need to stick to that.
Yeah, so there's no blanket no here. The important thing is transparency.
That's right.
I had a situation where I was working at a company, and our business development team decided that they were interested in acquiring a company that I was an advisor to. And so my company wanted me involved in the review of that startup. And the startup probably wanted me to be an advocate for the acquisition. And I was like, I need to recuse myself on both sides. But then I talked to my CEO and I talked to the startup CEO, and they both said, "We want you involved." So I basically, I sent a bunch of emails to the general counsels of both companies saying, "I feel like there's a conflict. I have insider information on both sides here, but if you want me to be part of it, and everybody's comfortable with that, that's fine." And everybody was comfortable with that. And so we had a fruitful M&A discussion. The acquisition didn't go forward. That startup ended up getting acquired by Microsoft instead. But it was perfectly okay because there was transparency, and the people who care, knew exactly what was going on.
Yeah. And it goes back to that transparency piece and making sure you follow the right company process, right? Transparent within company and externally of what's happening.
So it's transparency, due process, right? And setting the right expectations maybe in the beginning seems like the right ingredients for a smooth collaboration. But if we go like shifting left, maybe that's the word, in the beginning of the relationship, right? A new startup, maybe. Now, if the founders don't know anyone, how do they get in front of you? I mean, they could go through investors like me, go to events, and do you, I mean, you could probably get bombarded by requests. And if they don't know you or don't go through a trusted connection, seems like there's no hope for them to get in front of you, right? Okay.
Sadly, yeah. I always say this to startups. You're only going to get a security leader's attention if you say one of two things. If you come at us with a solution for the problem that's been keeping us up at night and we don't have an answer to, we're probably going to take that call, even if you're a startup, because it's the problem that's been keeping us up at night. We don't know the right answer. And so we're interested in those conversations. And we want to hear what the solutions are. And we won't just be asking that startup about them. We'll be asking them about the whole set of competition that they have, because we're in acquisition of information mode, and they're a good source. So there's value for us in that. But the startup has to hit the right security leader at the right time when they're actually, this is the topic that's keeping them up. The only other way they're going to get on my radar is if they can convince me that like deploying them is going to cost half as much money as my existing solution.
And okay, so but in terms of so Joe, you and I had this conversation some time ago. If you happen to have a problem that's really keeping you up at night and it's really need to be solved. And it happens to be the case that you met a startup like Phantom, right? And yeah, that great. That works out great, but that's a rare occurrence, right? So how do we make this? No?
I don't know that it's that rare now, because actually, right now, in particular, with all of the AI implementations happening, there are 100 AI security startups, and like we have to fork them. There's these AI startups using AI for security, to do it better. Like, I'm not talking about them. I'm talking the ones that are out there talking about helping us secure the LLMs that we're deploying in our enterprises. Those startups, like, we're probably more interested in looking at them because they're building solutions to deal with this new technology. All the old security startups are claiming that their existing product will solve all of your, all your issues with your LLMs. But
No. I mean, coming back to the root of the question is that, sure, there's a crop of new startups that addressing a problem that doesn't have an existing solution, that's a little bit easier to deal with. But should we as a community be more, say, proactive, saying, here's the things we work on. We like to talk to startups in these categories versus just sitting there and being bombarded by
Yes.
incoming queries that may have nothing to do with what we want.
Yeah, I think we should. Like, it's a really, right now, for example, I hear a lot of security leaders talking about inside their organizations doing custom homegrown identity and access management solutions because of a feeling that they don't, because identity and access management is so critical to security and they don't feel confident in the existing products out there. And to me, it's like, on the one hand, I'm like, this is fascinating. There should be 100 startups jumping into this space. But the flip side is building an entire identity and access management platform that can, you rip and replace Okta. That's a heavy lift. And so we do have these gap areas where I don't see the startup ecosystem jumping in, even though it's a pretty obvious area of need.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Some security teams or CISOs actually have startup days or garage days, right? Where they actually bring a portfolio of companies and they do kind of a two-way conversation. But here's what we're seeing our problems are within the industry, but also specifically in the company, right? Here is space where we're interested in partnering with somebody to address. And then a portfolio of companies, whoever they are. So let's say you have a strong relationship with Rain, right? Or a strong relationship with, I don't know, pick somebody, right? Another VC. If you have a good relationship, you could ask to bring the portfolio companies and do kind of a startup days where you can actually say, here is the areas of where we're struggling or interested to learn more about opportunities. And you have that kind of a showcase almost. I've seen not a lot, but small number of CISOs actually do that every single year. And
Yeah.
it worked pretty well for them. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody has a scale.
Yeah. Jim Roth used to do that. And I was at Twistlock. And I went to Jim. I say, hey, we're doing this thing. Is it interesting to you? And he said, it is. And come to this, I don't know what they
Yeah.
called back then. And I presented in November, I remember. And in February, he gave us a contract. And we were like, oh my goodness, this is awesome. But he opened up, they have these, sort of a days where the specific every quarter he brings in a number of startups to talk to his team.
What doesn't work well is RSA days, right? Where I call it speed dating, right? And a specific VC or multiple will have this get together. And literally, it's like speed dating. On one side of the room, you have all the CISOs trying to prove how brilliant they are, why they should be on the boards or on the advisory boards. On another side of the room, you have all the founders of the companies, and you have a VC in the middle, literally trying to put them all together, and they're not solving real problems. That's all about networking there. What works better, I think, and there's a number of advisory boards for VCs or industry, right, where they actually get with CISO and find out what are the top problems you're thinking about, what keeps you up at night, right, and where you think in the next 2, 3 years we should all as an industry focus on. And then based on that feedback, you can actually kind of correlate, right, and curate more of a startup day with the right companies coming in and ideas how to solve those problems versus just random, oh, you're in cybersecurity, we're in cybersecurity, let's put them together.
Yeah, I've never done the version where engaging with startups and telling them what you want, but I have consistently had those conversations with different VCs, Like there are quite, I could think of at least five or six VCs who try and have a conversation with me at least once every 6 months or a year to just to ask, like, because the VCs are thinking about what are they going to invest in next, and so they want to know, like, what are you and your peers worried about? Where are you seeing gaps in terms of, and so I have those conversations all the time with VCs, and then you sometimes see them go invest in those areas, and you're happy.
Yeah.
But
Actually, I became aware of a vendor CISO sort of a connection platform is trying to do it this way, is having the CISOs proactively put into the platform what they want, and then they make the connection there, which is interesting. Maybe we should do that here. We should, in one of the episodes, we can bring a few CISO funds and maybe some startups to talk about what we want, but what you guys want. And I always put myself in the practitioner category. What you want in terms of things that are big gaps for you that you really need a solution to address. And then we can have the startups talk about why they fill the gaps. That could be an interesting episode.
Yeah, I think that would be useful. There is a group in Bay Area, Joe knows of them, that does this, which is it's a group of CISOs, a Bay Area CISO group, that has kind of a vendor day where, depending on feedback from the number of CISOs, where the interesting space is, they will curate like number of two or three different vendors to present, and it happens rarely. It's not like a weekly occurrence, right? But one of the meetings are actually focused on that. So I think it
Is
would be
it called
beneficial.
Bay Area CISO Council or
There is a
oh,
number of them, but yeah.
yeah, okay.
So before we wrap up, I wanted to make sure I mentioned one other downside risk that I think security leaders need to think about when they're partnering with startups, and that is you're extending your security perimeter to include that startup. And so like a lot of startups don't prioritize their own cybersecurity defenses. And one of the things I always look at with when I'm partnering with a startup, I mean, I obviously we care about supply chain security and third-party risk with all the companies, but in particular with startups, we have to be careful. They may not have gotten security certifications themselves yet, although we're seeing them getting them earlier now. But they also may not have invested as much in security. And so looking at, like, I often talk when I'm talking to a startup, I say, I want you to offer a version of your product that I can host in my environment and that I can manage and not have my data going out into your cloud, et cetera. And so, like, especially if you talk about something like email security, do you really want every single email in your corporation to be going through some little email security company and them having a copy of all your, and access to all your email?
But then it's hard, right? So having someone's engineering a product and the product is deployed on premises at in different locations and they different versions, it's hard to keep up. It's hard, right? So
But the way to, and Joe's correct, right? Which is you have to think about it as your standard kind of a third party risk here, except it's much higher or much elevated risk, right? Because now for many of those security tools, you have to give them domain-wide privileged access. And a lot of times they have very high-level privileged access, right? So you need to do your due diligence when you engage with those startups to make sure that they have the right security controls in place, they have the right visibility in place. And some of those startups don't have it, right? Their goal is to move quickly, get product, get revenue up, and they might be missing some of the core kind of security controls in place that will be very critical, and that's a risk and danger.
but don't you guys all have vendor onboarding practices where not penetration testing and all that, or certification as part? No?
So VSA, I'm shaking not for my company, but I'm saying as an industry, a standard VSA, which is vendor security assessments processes, are not that useful to manage risk. They're compliance based. Are you certified SOC 2? Do you have this compliance? Are you doing pen testing? It's a checklist. And they actually, it's more like security theater. that actual real in-depth security analysis of somebody's environment. It's hard to do that at scale, by the way. If you have hundreds of vendors you're working with, you can't review every single vendor. So you have to go with the basic compliance for many companies. But that doesn't actually tell you the real story behind them.
But so then you either take the risk or you have to dig into deeply, right? If you are going to collaborate with them in the way that they can have access to your critical data and infra.
That's right. This is where you invest your time, right? Based on your risk posture, what access they have, what data they have, right? If it's some basic non-PII marketing data or information that if it gets leaked out or pwned, it's the risk-wise you can manage that. You probably are okay with getting standard compliance check, right? If they have privileged access or they have access to PII or they hold your PII, you want to do much more in-depth review of their product.
I remember in the past talking to the Citibank security team, and in the beginning, that was when I was on the vendor company days, and they were like, "Gen Z, let me tell you, it's 18 months to get a contract because we do all these in-depth security reviews and penetration testing." And sure enough, it was actually a little longer than 18 months before we got a deal from them. So that's a long process. All right. So this has been really interesting, educational for me too. There are a few nuggets that I didn't know that was happening in companies too. So like vendor management being embedded in security team, for instance. Super interesting. I'm sure founders will find this episode really enlightening as well. So for them to understand a little bit more about your mindset and your processes. Thank you so much for the time today, and see you next time on another episode.
Yeah.
Awesome.
By the way, can you stop recording? Can we stop recording?
Yeah, I'm stuck. I know.